Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast.
Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. We are going to talk about George Harrison's All Things Must Pass today. We've already spoken about John Lennon and Yoko and his Plastic Ono bands and McCartney's McCartney, both 50-year-old albums. And today we're going to look at George's, not necessarily his debut solo album, if you're being pedantic, but the one that we kind of see as the debut solo album. And here's a redundant question. Do you like All Things Must Pass, Stephen?
Nah, it's okay. It's all right.
Yeah, it'll do.
I've been waiting for three series to get this episode over the line.
And, you know, when you think of, big triple albums and, you know, 70s excess, I think it's suitable that we approach All Things Must Pass by means of a triple Nothing Is Real episode approach. It seems kind of sensible, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, you're getting your patience is being rewarded, Stephen. So we're looking at doing a triple All Things Must Pass. And today, a little bit like our anthology episode, we're going to look at the road to All Things Must Pass and how George eventually ended up recording, you know, his debut solo albums, but also the experimental solo albums he made along the way. And, everybody loves All Things Must Pass. I know we're joking, but, you know, it is it the best Beatles solo album?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for listening to Nothing Is Real.
One thing I would say about All Things Must Pass is you don't have to like the Beatles to like All Things Must Pass.
That's a very good point. That is a good point.
You seem surprised. And it is probably, for people, because apparently there's these people in the world who say things like, I don't like the Beatles. I just don't like the Beatles. I never connected with them and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think All Things Must Pass, you don't have to know anything about the Beatles. It really is a disconnected thing. You can just hand it off to somebody and say, just listen to this.
I think so. I think that's absolutely a fair comment. What I like about this is really George seems to be trying to be putting as much distance between himself and the Beatles as possible. And certainly of all of the sort of solo albums that are coming out in 1970, 1971, this I think is the one that sounds least like the Beatles. It doesn't wear those influences on the surface, at least.
Well, they're all kind of trying to put some clear water between themselves and the Beatles. If you take John, Paul, and George's albums, and they're doing it in probably in ways that you wouldn't expect. Like Paul is trying to, totally reverse his Abbey Road production style, and John is trying to cut around the things he said before to talk about himself. And then George is going for a much more collaborative, meditative type approach.
Yes, and I think you see this. You see this early in his career, then particularly as you get into the latter half of the 60s and with the creation of Apple. And Apple is very much John and Paul's baby, if you like. And George can be quite dismissive about Apple. But actually, of all four of them, he is the one that was probably the most hands-on for the longest time. Mm. And he does seem to thrive in that sort of collaborative environment. And we sort of see this in, we're looking at the sort of really his Wonderwall and those early albums and up into All Things Must Pass. And you can see the beginnings of that collaborative approach that really informs a lot of his solo career.
Yeah, we'll talk about George's collaborations as we go through this. So let's rewind back a little bit and let's just spend a few minutes thinking about, George's role as a songwriter within the Beatles and kind of finding his own creative voice. And I always like George's explanation about how he came to be a songwriter, which was, John and Paul were doing it. Like this is what my mates are doing. Why can't I do it?
Yes, I mean he talks about that first song "Don't Bother Me" that crops up on with the Beatles as being an exercise to see if he could actually write a song. Mm. So you're in a band with arguably the greatest songwriting team, pop music songwriting team of the 20th century. What are you going to do? Have a crack at it yourself and see if you can compete with them. And I mean, I think the fact that he is competing with them or has to compete with them is hugely important in looking at his output.
And the competition angle is interesting because, you know, if you look at the John and Paul axis and the Ringo George axis, Ringo seems to be, we kind of said before, he seems to be like the Beatles fan within the Beatles and is kind of admirably, you know, applying himself to whatever songs are rocking up. And I can't think off the top of my head of any sort of George quote that says, man, they were really two great songwriters, John and Paul. He doesn't rock. He doesn't sort of say things like that or give a nod to those kind of things. He sort of thinks, well, you know, I'm here. I'm just as worthy.
I think the issue, we touched on this in an early episode, which is this idea that Paul and John sort of carved up the songwriting early on. So they actually, you know, Mark Lewison talks about this in the book, that they literally sat down and decided, well, you and I will put our names on these songs, and regardless of whether you write it or I write it or how it's apportioned, should we cut George in? And they decided between themselves, no. So there was a decision taken early on. And I mean, I think George looked at that more in the early days from the point of view of the financial impact of that. You know, he was very conscious of the fact that suddenly John and Paul were the sort of wealthiest, they were earning. He and Ringo weren't. So although he talks about, you know, I just wrote this song, don't bother me, as an exercise, you've got to think he would have been very conscious of the money that was rolling in under the Lennon-McCartney banner.
And there is precedent because, you know, the thing we haven't mentioned is In Spite of All the Danger, which eventually appeared on Anthology 1, which is accredited as a McCartney-Harrison co-write. But it's not really a co-write.
No, I mean, Paul is very clear that he wrote the song. George came up with the guitar solo and Paul gave him the credit because, as he said, that's how we thought it worked at the time.
Paul calmed down pretty fast.
I was going to say, it suddenly realized, and there are these stories about Epstein and George Martin and Dick James sort of explaining to them that, you know, how publishing worked and how royalties worked. And, you know, there's these very sort of charming comments that either Paul or John make about, you know, we thought songs just, we didn't realize people could own songs, that they were just in the air. They just existed. But yeah, he cottoned on. I think they both cottoned on pretty quick.
And In Spite of All the Danger, still in Paul's most recent set lists, his most recent live set lists.
Yes.
Which is really, the last time I saw him was December 2018 in Liverpool. And he sings In Spite of All the Danger. And you think, that's still a crowd sing-along. You know, from the start, he was delivering those kind of songs.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and it was interesting to hear the crowd did sort of sing along. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was a song that everyone knew. So it's a song that since Anthology is sort of in the, if not the public consciousness, at least his audience consciousness.
So we digress a little bit. So Don't Bother Me on With the Beatles is the first George written song. And I suppose, you know, if you're Brian Epstein or Dick James, you know, and, you know, John and Paul are, you know, making coin and doing well, sure, why not see what George is capable of doing and see what he delivers? And Don't Bother Me is kind of, you certainly get a mark of George from this very first song of what his inner workings might be like.
I think so. I think that's one of the most fascinating things about his career as a songwriter is that it's there right from the beginning.
And it's not there with John and Paul. You don't have a sense of what John and Paul's internal monologue is about necessarily from their songwriting at that stage. But in 63 from George, you do.
You do. You know, John and Paul are sitting down that eyeball-to-eyeball exercise, and they're writing songs. Well, now this one we'll write in the third person. This will be a thank you to the fans. This yeah. will be, we'll build on the harmonica riff from the previous hit single. So there's a maybe, you know, a calculation is maybe the wrong word, but there's a craft there, and they're sort of looking at the market. You do get a sense, Don't Bother Me is just George saying, you know, go away, don't bother me.
Yeah.
And it's he is invested in that song. Mm. You know, supposedly he was ill with a cold or the flu in a hotel room. So, I mean, that maybe informs the content, but it you do absolutely get a sense of his personality, and that is pretty consistent all the way through. And his use of slightly odd, slightly sour sounding arrangements and melodies, and it's all there right from the beginning.
And so two more albums pass before he doesn't get more songs onto a Beatles album until Help in 1965. But then another anthology track, You Know What to Do, kind of is recorded in 64. That's a bit of a slight kind of song.
I can understand. I think it always strikes me that it sounds like a Ruttles outtake.
Yes, it does. And he is trying to get to a point.
He is trying, and it's obviously Revolver is Rubber Soul and Revolver, which George all sort of famously said in Anthology, you know, it was all just one album, which came first. Can't really distinguish between the two, but that's really for me where the songwriting starts to dramatically mature.
Yeah, and I think so. You know, you look at Revolver, and you know, he gets the prime album opening track there, Taxman. Interestingly, Paul's doing the solo there and isn't looking for a songwriter credit, but but he gets, you know, he obviously gets three songs on Revolver, which is a lot for George. And then there's kind of a shift in 67. He's recording songs that aren't getting put out, essentially. He's getting songs kind of put to one side, and he's not really playing the guitar, and he's getting into the sitar, and the spiritual angle is coming up. So he's, you know, he is having a quiet revolution as we get from 66 to 68.
Yeah, I think that's fair. He's writing songs, you know, Only a Northern Song, It's All Too Much, which I would kind of rate as probably one of their best psychedelic efforts. But these are sort of being relegated to, you know, the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. So they're sort of really being you know, pushed out of contention for singles and albums.
Yeah. Like there's four George songs recorded in 67. Two of them get bumped out of 67.
Yeah.
And for a guy who's not getting much on, to say, hey, 50% of what you've recorded is going onto the subs bench is, it must start to rankle a little bit.
Yes. I mean, I think so. And you do see a change in 68. With the songs that he's writing, and that's the start, I think, of this sort of next phase of his songwriting, where which will ultimately lead to All Things Must Pass.
Yeah, you get a sense of what he is solo, and so at the start of 68, this kind of leads us nicely into essentially the first George solo album, which is Wonderwall. So at the start of 68, he's in India recording backing tracks for the Wonderwall soundtrack, and one of those tracks becomes his first Beatles B-side, The Inner Light.
Yeah.
And The Inner Light, everybody loves The Inner Light. But The Inner Light is a leftover piece of music from the Wonderwall soundtrack, and that's essentially George's first solo album. And the Wonderwall soundtrack is quite good.
I do like this. It is a soundtrack proper. It's short, a lot of short instrumental pieces. It's probably the first time that he is really marrying East and West. You know, on the Beatles tracks on Revolver, he's sort of embellishing Western pop songs with the sitar or Indian arrangements. Within You, Without You is a wholesale sort of Indian exercise, but this is his first attempt to sort of marry the two. I actually think it's very listenable.
Yeah.
It you know, I can't recommend the film particularly. It's very much
I have not seen the film. It's odd how there's a whole tranche of films that we only talk about. I know we mentioned this in the Ringo episode a little bit, but we only talk about them because the Beatles did a soundtrack, or Mick Jagger appears in them, or Pink Floyd are somehow involved. There's about 20 films that would have disappeared into the blue night sky if there hadn't been some kind of hairy hippie in the background playing some foreign instrument.
I've never seen
Wonderwall.
I think that's right. I did buy it on DVD, and I think I did make it to the end, but it is very dated. I mean, you could sort of carbon date it just by the style of the cinematography, and it's really quite suspect in terms of its gender politics, shall we say.
Now, it's interesting to put it up against Paul's The Family Way, because Paul had done The Family Way in 66 as a soundtrack project, but that's very slight. That's really George Martin in disguise, and Paul's name is plastered all over the front. It's not really, Wonderwall is actually George rolling up his sleeves and making proper music.
Yes, I mean, I think for the Family Way, Paul came up with a little sequence of melody, and George Martin just embellished that and turned it into a soundtrack. But you know, the McCartney name sells. But here, George actually sits down, watches the film with a stopwatch, and then goes in and says, "Right, we need a piece of music that lasts for 2 minutes and 10.5 seconds." So then he comes up with that. And again, he's collaborating. So he's got Clapton, he's got Peter Tork, he's got the Remo 4, he's got the Indian musicians he's working with him in Bombay. And another person that's on this album is a guy called John Barham.
Yeah, now John Barham is someone who he starts working with, and basically he keeps him in his Rolodex, more or less. So this is an important kind of relationship.
This is a very important relationship. John Barham was a classical musician who was really at that stage a student of Ravi Shankar. And what Barham did was take George's musical ideas, and notate them so that he could then present these to the Indian musicians. But Barham will sort of drift around in the Beatles orbit for a while, but he has a lifelong friendship that starts at this point with George. So he will be doing orchestrations on All Things Must Pass, Living in the Material World. He is the man responsible for the choral arrangements on Long and Winding Road and Across the Universe, but perhaps we'll forget
Skip
him
that.
For those.
But he's working with George up until the end of his career. He's on Chance of India and
So right up until 1997, Chance of India, he's there as well.
So Wonderwall overlaps with the Beatles, because on the reissued Wonderwall CD a few years ago, we got the demo backing track of The Inner Light, or an alternate take of The Inner Light.
Yes.
And it's what's more fascinating is the little snippets of dialogue, and you hear some of it on the Pepper Box as well, where George is interacting with the musicians, trying to get across what he wants to get across. And you do sometimes have to think, goodness me, because, you know, the Inner Light soundtrack was recorded in part in Bombay. You know, here's this guy who 4 years ago is from Liverpool singing Don't Bother Me. And now it's January 68. He's in Bombay. He's talking to some instruments. He's, you know, trying to explain the point of what he's doing and getting his point across. And
it's crazy.
Working.
I mean, it's absolutely crazy that you could go from Liverpool to Bombay in that space of time. And as you say, he's working with sort of classical Indian musicians, and albeit he's got John Barham as a sort of musical interpreter, but he's collaborate. It is very much a collaboration.
Yeah.
And I say that it seems to me this is the first solo album by a Beatle. It's the first album that comes out on the Apple label. And it really informs, it really sets out a sort of a template for this collaborative approach that we mentioned earlier, that sort of informs his whole career. You know, if he needs to get a guitar player, well, he'll pick up the phone and ring Eric Clapton. If Peter Tork happens to be passing by, he'll get him involved. So he's very open. And all the way through, you know, you get this sense, particularly late 60s, early 70s, and then again in the mid 80s, George is just someone that likes being in a band. Doesn't necessarily like being in the Beatles, particularly by 1970, but he likes the sort of comradeship or the camaraderie of a band setup.
So Wonderwall comes out, and this is, you know, this leads into the White Album period. We should probably also mention Electronic Sound, which comes out in 69, which is George's second open inverted commas solo album, close inverted commas, which he moves from the Apple label to the Zappel label. And I don't know if I listened. I certainly haven't listened to Electronic Sound twice. And it's I guess it's setting itself up by putting itself out on this experimental Zappel label that this is not tunes.
Yes, I mean, this is really the point of the Zappel label, and there's a, you know, an entire episode to be done on the Zappel label, which was the sort of avant-garde offshoot of Apple. And, you know, there were only two records released on that label. One was Electronic Sound, and the other was John and Yoko's Life with the Lions. But, you know, there were big plans for Zappel. And there's a very good book, The Zappel Diaries. Mm. And I would recommend people read that, because it gives you a real insight into what they were doing, what the sort of ethos and the ideas underlying the label were, and really surprising to me how involved Paul was. You sort of think, you know, he's off producing Mary Hopkin and hanging out with Donovan, learning to play the guitar, and but actually he is front and center in this sort of avant-garde aspect of, a lot of which then was just shut down whenever Klein came on board. But Electronic Sound is basically, if we're being honest about it, it's George trying out his new Moog Series 3 synthesizer.
Part of it is not even him, isn't it? Like, there's it's Bernie Krause is a part of this.
Exactly. I was going to say this is his first brush with plagiarism, but his first brush with plagiarism was It's All Too Much, where he sings with your long blonde hair and your eyes are blue, and that, which is a line from the song Sorrow. And I think that was settled with some money out of court. But yeah, Kreis says, you know, he was demonstrating the instrument to Harrison, and he didn't really realize it was being recorded. Mm. And then the next thing, suddenly it appears on an album. And George did offer to sort of give him a credit, and I think the sleeve does credit him, except Kreis then said, I want nothing to do with this, and George just took silver paint and painted his name out. But so yeah, it's very strange. There's a very good book by Michael Lang about George's music, and he describes this as, and I'm going to quote here, one of the worst records of all time.
Low praise indeed.
Low praise indeed. All Music gives it a 4-star review. So, you know, you pay your money and you take your chances.
As I said, I haven't listened to it a second time. Bernie Krause is, you know, the My Beloved Monkeys were one of the first bands to get a Moog synthesizer on record in 1967. So Bernie Krause is involved with the Monkees' song Star Collector, which, if anybody out there is unfamiliar with, is well worth digging out, because the synthesizer on that is insane. And also Daily Nightly by Nesmith. So that's what I find interesting and or funny or amusing about these records is how they don't sell. And I know they're experimental and they're not supposed to sell, but you must think that if you owned a record shop in 68, 69, and you had a record with George Harrison's name on the front of it, that it would at least get a bit better than whatever it was, 196 or whatever it got to in the US charts. These things just stay glued to the shelves.
It's funny because, you know, you think 4 years earlier, in 1964, there was a scramble to put out anything that had the Beatles.
Yeah, like interview discs and all sorts of crazy stuff was hitting the charts.
Yeah, you know, these different configurations, particularly in America. But here, it's hard to, you know, there's clearly two versions, Life with the Lions, Electronic Sound, the Zappel label. Mm. This is a mark. This is a clear distinction. This is not the Beatles. This is not Hey Jude. This is not the White Album.
But it's interesting how the general public knew that. It's interesting that the general public knew that. They just could sense that this is not a George Harrison album, and we're not going to buy it.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, the idea. You know, you wonder if George had if there had been some vocal track, if George had maybe written lyrics and had to, that might have been different, but this is what it is. It's a soundtrack.
Yeah, like a kind of a Bowie, Bud of Suburbia type thing, where there's like a single to hook everyone in, and then
if he'd released a solo single, but it's clearly it's seen as something else.
Yeah,
you know, it's something else, and the Zappa label, I think, was quite clearly the marker of something that's a little bit out there. I should say the very good BBC radio documentary on the Zappa label, which you can get on YouTube, and we could put up a link. We'll
put up a link for that. So this brings us up to the start of 1969. Electronic Sounds comes out in the middle of 69. But if you're thinking about All Things Must Pass, the album comes out in December 1970, and there's a thread that kind of goes back to January 1969 that puts the album together. And so January 1969 is famously the month of the Get Back / Let It Be sessions. They're in Twickenham, they're in Apple, they're on the roof, and they're at each other's throats. But George's 1969 starts with these sessions and starts with him walking out of the Beatles one day.
Yes. And he can be heard sort of mulling over the possibility of a solo album. So this is really, as far as I'm aware, it's during these sessions that he first starts floating the idea of some kind of solo album, and we start to get references in the conversations to the stockpile of songs that he has, that things have been building up, and there are discussions about, you know, John in particular sort of encouraging, well, why don't you put a solo album out? You know, Yoko and I are doing that. You could do that. You could get these songs out that way.
And at what point, something I've never been able to figure out, and maybe we can't answer this question, but it seems there's a tipping point where George's stockpile of songs goes from being kind of an accidental collection, maybe, of overflow songs, into being a conscientious collection of keeping songs to himself.
Yes.
And because in January 1969, during Let Back Get It Be, he is bringing in All Things Must Pass to try and get the Beatles to perform it.
Yeah.
And, it there's great bootlegs out there of it, and it's lovely to hear the Beatle harmonies on some of these rough takes of it, but he's not pushing it. He's not really pushing any song during Let Back Get It Be, particularly.
No. I mean, he is coming into those sessions off the back of sort of falling in love with the band.
Yeah.
And your favorite band. The band ruined everything.
I think the band ruined everything. I know I'm not denying the talent of the band, but I certainly think that their worthiness sometimes rankles with me.
All that authenticity.
All that brown.
Yeah, all that brown. Everything went brown.
Yeah, but George is enamored by the band at this point.
He is incredibly, you know, he and Clapton are famously sort of enamored. I mean, George, I think, describes them as the best band in the universe. And there's obviously an element of putting his own band and John and Paul down by saying that. But so he's coming in and clearly wants to have that collaborative approach that he has seen with the band and with Dylan, and he's just not getting it. And he's bringing in absolutely top tier songs. I mean, I don't think anybody could argue that All Things Must Pass is anything other than a top tier song, and he's getting no traction whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, John in particular, you can hear him in these sessions complaining about all of the chords. You know, these are too tricky. These are sort of difficult chords, and John doesn't like that. So there does come a point after George has walked out where when one of the conditions of him coming back is to say, none of my songs will be performed in the live show, wherever that may be.
And that's specific. He did specifically say that?
Yeah, he withdraws his songs from consideration for the live show.
Right.
So that's the first thing. And the second thing, if you look at the songs, his songs that end up on the Let It Be album, I mean, particularly the one I think of is For You Blue.
Mm.
That's a very simple
little 12-bar blues. Elmore James got nothing blues on this one, baby. All that stuff.
And you do get a sense, I think, at this point that he is holding back. He's just accepting of the fact that these songs are not going to be recorded by the Beatles, are not going to be accepted for this particular project. Certainly, he comes up with For You Blue, and there is a sense, I think, that he's dumbing down for John. Mm. You know, we know that John around that time was the heroin baps had come into play. And there's a sense, I think, you know, you can, why, given that George ultimately goes on to be known for his slide guitar work, why is John playing that guitar? And you do have a sense of, he throws John the solo and the cigarette lighter that John uses to play. You know, it's a kind of, let's keep John interested. We'll give him a little 12-bar blues. I have one. We can do that and let him play the solo, and that will keep him kind of on board and keep him engaged. But you do get a sense, I think, that this is the point at which he's kind of acknowledging these songs are not for the Beatles.
It's very sad in a way. It's sad that George is somebody who went on to have great working relationships with other musicians, but could not find a working relationship within his own band. But yep. Not only that, I think he, you know, in contrast to Ringo, I don't think he was a fan of the Beatles at that point. And he kind of starts 69 by leaving the Beatles, and he sort of, you know, floats above, certainly some of that Let It Be, Get Back activity. He's very much present at best.
Yeah. It's this idea, you know, you look at the rooftop concert and everyone says this, they're having a ball. They're having a great time. You look at that recording of For You Blue and they all seem to be getting along great, and they can lose themselves in the moment.
Yes.
I think. And George can do that. But I think there's a point in
Think about it, or they can't talk about it.
No. If you stop to think about it, or you stop to discuss it, if you interrupt the kind of, the moment of creation is fine.
Yeah.
But I think this is the point in early 69 where George realizes that his ability to have a genuine sort of creative input.
Yeah.
And to take the band in a particular direction. He wants the Beatles to move in the direction of the band. And you can see that the frustrating thing is that that's arguably also what Paul seems to want at that stage. It's a kind of stripping back. You know, we're a great little band. Let's get out on the road. George frustratingly wants that too, but they just can't find a way to make it work. But George, I think, does have that passive-aggressive thing.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't push his songs forward. It's that, you know, I'll play what you want me to play, or I'll not play at all. And that's his response. And they just seem unable to, as you say, to be able to find a way of working.
Yeah. Maybe it's unfair to say George isn't a fan, but I certainly think in 69 he starts to realize that the Beatles are not the most important thing.
No.
That there are other avenues to go through. So you look at George's 69, and he's, you know, 2 years earlier in 67, he's not really playing guitar at all. But then in 69, he's doing an awful lot of things. He's producing, he's recording with other people outside the Beatles. He's writing with other people outside the Beatles. He's doing albums, he's doing singles. So let's think about some of those things. He's producing lots of stuff for the Apple label, some stuff that's really good and has stood the test of time.
Absolutely. I would say that it's the Apple output that George is involved in most directly that does stand the test of time.
Yeah, it's got heart and soul. It's great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I make an exception. The best release on Apple that wasn't by the Beatles was Mary Hopkins' Earth Song. That is a great song, but a great album. When John is tiring of the Beatles, he goes off and starts making records with Yoko. The interesting thing to me is that at this stage, George is not thinking of a solo album. So he is working with Jackie Lomax, which is a fantastic album. He gets the Krishna Temple into the charts, into the singles charts.
Yeah.
You know, he produces albums for Billy Preston, for Doris Troy, and that sort of work with them, that sort of soul and gospel, will just come back and pay dividends when we get into his work on All Things Must Pass and Living in the Material.
Yeah, it's more stuff that he's putting into the mental Rolodex and the actual Rolodex of feelings.
Absolutely. And what he's also doing is honing his production skills.
Yeah.
So he's learning how to work the studio. He does a very good production job on songs by Badfinger. He works with Derek and Lon Van Eaton. There's a couple of tracks on their album Brother that sound like they've just dropped off All Things Must Pass. And he's also writing songs with other people. So he's co-writing with Billy Preston. You know, obviously he co-writes Badge with Eric Clapton. So these are the first co-writes, significant co-writes outside the Beatles.
Let's talk about Badge for a second, because that is an interesting little song.
Yeah.
So Badge by Cream, which was recorded actually at the end of 68, 21st November 68, and it's a co-write between Clapton and Harrison.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's a very 70s type of song.
It is. It's very, I think it's very forward looking. Mm. I mean, it has, as you say, it was recorded in November 68. The song that sort of precedes it for me is While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Okay.
It has a similar sort of sound in terms of the way the guitars are recorded, and also those sort of arpeggiated passages in the middle are really looking forward to Abbey Road.
Yes.
And that guitar style. And for years, I assumed that was what George brought to the table. But that's actually Clapton playing that part.
Yeah.
George is playing rhythm guitar. And I knew he was credited under a pseudonym as rhythm guitar, but I just assumed because of the Abbey Road style of playing that was him. But it is. That chap, Michael Lang, that I referred to, he describes it as a new type of rock pop song.
Yeah.
And particularly coming from someone that up to this point, Clapton had been regarded himself very much as a sort of blues purist.
Yeah.
It's an interesting development. And you can see also it prefigures Blind Faith and that style and that the sound of that album.
Yeah. And it has a couple of little threads in it. As you say, the Abbey Road thread and, you know, that little descending arpeggio is reflected back in George, kind of carries it over into Something. And into Here Comes the Sun. But it does have this kind of 70s sound, and it you know, it's that kind of early 70s kind of classic rock radio, AM radio rock. You kind of hear it through that, and as you say, it kind of it's away from Clapton's usual blues abilities. So it's an interesting little song, and you can kind of see, it's like a little crack where you can kind of see what's coming down the tracks a little bit.
Yeah, and it's a Ringo co-write as well, but he doesn't get a credit. George says Ringo came in drunk and gave us the line about the swans living in the park.
Oh,
so there you go.
Didn't know that.
There you go.
So he's working with lots of people. He's also working outside of the Beatles and outside of Apple with Jack Bruce and Leon Russell and a Birmingham supergroup, which do you want to tell us the name of that Birmingham supergroup?
The Birmingham supergroup is called Balls.
Right. And who is in Balls?
This is your kind of group.
I know.
It's got, it has Denny Lane.
Yeah.
Rick Gretsch, who was in Blind Faith, but also Trevor Burton of The Move.
Ah, The Move. What a band. The band that Pink Floyd could have been. But they didn't really go anywhere. This was kind of later in 69 that they were...
didn't really go anywhere, but George sort of was dropping in on their rehearsals and jamming with them, and it never really, I think there's maybe a single out there. I'm sure someone will be able to tell us what that single is or have a copy of it, but it didn't, it's the group that could have been.
Yeah, but it's funny that Denny Lane was in George's orbit before Wings. I wonder,
yes,
on the big open topped Wings over Europe bus, did Denny tell Paul about his time hanging out with George?
Jamming with George.
But probably maybe the most formative thing that George did was towards the end of 68, which was when he joined the tour of Delaney and Bonnie.
And yes,
this is interesting because, you know, I always find it funny that Paul in the Get Back, Let It Be thing is like, we're a great little band. Let's get in a bus. Let's turn up and do gigs. Yeah. And everyone says, Paul, shut your mouth. And then John gets on a plane and goes to Toronto and plays some stuff ad hoc. And George does a version of it with Delaney and Bonnie. So it's like, yeah, Paul, we want to do it, just not with
it is really hard to sort of imagine what Paul must have felt when he kind of opened the paper and saw, George is touring England with Delaney and Bonnie, and John is flying to, Eric's there. All right, okay. It's very odd to think what he must have, his reaction to that was.
So let's talk about Delaney and Bonnie. I have to admit, Delaney and Bonnie is not really my kind of bag.
Delaney and Bonnie are one of those bands that they're like Marmite. Mm. You know, they divide the nation, I think. I do like Delaney and Bonnie, and they are a hugely influential band for a band that really didn't have a lot of success themselves. You know, they sort of influenced, the huge influence on Clapton, on Harrison, Leon Russell, that whole sort of early 70s Southern gospel rock style of music all sort of flows out of this.
Yeah, and George loved them so much, he wanted to get them onto Apple at one point. I think they were signed to Elektra, is that right?
Yes, they'd had a couple of albums, and they recorded their second album, I think, called Accept No Substitute. And that had Bobby Whitlock, Carl Rattle, Jim Keltner. George heard this and said, yep, we're gonna put this out, sign you to Apple. Unfortunately, they were already signed to Elektra, which either he didn't know or they neglected. My guess would be that Delaney Bramlett didn't bother mentioning that. But there are pressings. It's a very rare Apple album, and there are pressings of that album. The catalog number was assigned, and I was once offered a copy of this in a record shop.
You did or didn't purchase?
I did not buy it. It was several years ago, and it was £750, which was way outside my budget. But
I bet you regret it now, though, Stephen.
I do regret it now. I mean, if anybody has a spare copy, if they'd like to let me know, or better yet, just put it in the post to the Nothing Israel headquarters. That would be most appreciated.
I'm sure the Germans have a word for, you know, that thought you have of a record you put back in the racks many years ago that you should have bought. But
I experience that often.
So the Delaney and Bonnie tour, he's not really on tour with them for a long period of time, but again, he's collecting experiences and people that will feed into All Things Must Pass. So Jim Gordon, Bobby Whitlock, and Jim Keltner is going to be a lifelong friend who ends up being obviously drummer for the Wilburys as well as everybody else. So it's really only in December 69 that Harrison just joins the tour spontaneously.
More or less, he 1st of December he is at the Albert Hall to see the band, goes backstage. According to Delaney, he said, can I be in the band? And he said, yeah, of course, we'll pick you up tomorrow morning. And literally the next day, the tour bus rocks up outside George's house. Patty packs him some sandwiches and off he goes. And suddenly he's touring and as a rhythm guitar player. And then one of the most formative things here is he is asked to play a slide part.
Right.
And so suddenly he says, okay. And he learns how to play slide guitar. So he's on stage playing slide guitar really for the first time and developing his own style of doing that. You know, he's not a Ry Cooder style slide player, but this is where he sort of picks up that instrument.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the slide guitar for George is really a kind of a solo George type sound. And it appears on All Things Must Pass, and it kind of starts at this point, right at the end of the 60s on tour with Delaney and Bonnie. And the other thing that kind of starts to arise on this tour, and we'll talk about it in the next part, but this is where My Sweet Lord starts to germinate as well on this tour.
Yes, yes, because he's hanging out with this band, which is a very sort of loose conglomeration of people that come from that gospel style. And My Sweet Lord is really written that it starts to germinate as part of this, where George is sort of vamping away on the chords backstage at a press call after a press conference, and everyone's kind of throwing ideas into the mix. And it is that kind of gospel feel comes out of Delaney and Bonnie. You know, they spawned the Joe Cocker Mad Dogs and Englishmen review, Leon Russell. It's pure gospel are in their roots.
Yeah. So it's a short tour. As part of it, he takes to the stage of the Liverpool Empire, which he's says yes. He brings back a lot of memories, and that must have been a bit of an interesting way to close out the decade for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think, you know, did people go along thinking it's George Harrison, we're going to get to see George Harrison?
Well, was it really known? I mean, if you think about how news travelled in those days, by the time it hit the NME or Melody Maker, the tour would have been wrapped
been
up,
over.
Really.
Yeah. You think these days it would be on Twitter and sold out in seconds.
But, exactly, if you think about how quickly we knew about James Corden and Carpool Karaoke. I was following that on Twitter in real time. So we, at the end of that tour, Delaney and Bonnie and John and Yoko and the Plastic Ono Supergroup play this kind of UNICEF gig on December 15th, 1969.
The Plastic Ono Supergroup.
Yeah, so it's a bit of an overlap of what's been going on. And if people are, you know, paying attention at home, you know, the other things that are kind of happening at the end of 69 is that, you know, Paul has been up in Scotland, as we mentioned on the McCartney episode, you know, lying low. You know, the band are trying to figure out what to do in the wake of Lennon saying that it's over. But certainly, you know, that the September meeting where Lennon says, I'm out of it, or I'm out of here, or both, is... you know, it even that doesn't spur George on to say, oh, I better, like, Paul gets the message and starts putting solo work together in his head, but George is still not recording solo stuff.
No, this is the phrase you coined, you know, Schrodinger's Beatles, that they are together but not together. And you know, my reading of this is that even after Lennon made that announcement, he'd made this type of announcement before. You know, he'd called meetings for one purpose or another, and you just sort of let John say these things and then you move on. And this is the point at which, when we talked about in the McCartney episode, that they almost come to an end, I think, by accident. You know, there's not much happening in that period. And it's really only in sort of after Instant Karma, that kind of February, March, that it starts to dawn, I think, even on Paul, that this is it. And he kicks his solo album into gear. But even then, George is not committing to a solo project. In the sense of a solo, you know, a fully blown solo album.
So the timeline, as we've talked about before, is that right at the start of January 1970, Paul, George and Ringo spent 2 days in Abbey Road. They record I Me Mine, the last new Beatles song, and obviously a George written song. And it had to be recorded because he's seen kind of busking it in the Let It Be movie. And they said, we want a recording for the film. So they made that happen. And then at the end of January 1970, John records Instant Karma and puts that out. And then there's this tumultuous period of time between February and May 1970, where Paul is finishing his album. There's a lot of aggravation in Apple as to how and when that's going to come out, trying to get Let It Be over the finish line. You know, Ringo is involved in some of the orchestral overdubs for Let It Be. And George is obviously aware that it's happening and aware that it's coming out, because there's the John George Ringo axis in Apple, and Paul is kind of withdrawn from Apple. Yeah. And in that early 1970 period, George. He's still working with Billy Preston. He's doing his album, isn't that right?
Yes, I mean he is still very actively involved with Apple, and this is the irony. Paul, and again in a kind of slightly passive aggressive way that might be more characteristic perhaps of George, has just withdrawn.
Yeah,
Klein is in and sort of, you know, clearing out what he perceives to be dead wood, but George is still in there, still involved, producing and working with Billy Preston on Encouraging Words, which is his second solo album.
So you get to, it's really only when we get to May 1970 that George puts his foot forward and takes all these cumulative experiences from the previous 18 months and starts to take definitive steps for making a solo album. So McCartney's album's been out in April, Let It Be. The movie and album's about to come out in May 1970. And it starts really at the 1st of May 1970, where George has a session with his new best friend, really.
His new best friend, Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Is he, I forget which Wilbury he was. Otis? Was he Otis Wilbury?
Lucky.
Lucky.
because I remember at Bob Fest, remember the Bob Fest?
Yeah.
Concert, George comes out and said, you know, people... Some may call him Bobby, some may call him Zimmy. I call him Lucky. And I thought initially I wasn't making the Wilbury connection, and I thought it's like I just regard him as being lucky to have the career he's had.
I thought
it was a put down, but it was Lucky Wilbury.
So yeah, the Wilbury brothers, George and Bob, record a session together on the 1st of May 1970, and it's been bootlegged. And it's laid back.
That's very generous. It's very generous. At the time, this did make the papers.
Yeah.
It made the music press, and Rolling Stone later in the month they reported on this, and it was you know, a Beatle collaborating with Dylan, and it was a slightly shocking, scandalous thing, and. The Rolling Stone, I'm going to read this, on the 28th of May, said, Bob Dylan snuck into Columbia's Studio B in New York on May Day and recorded for 12 hours with George Harrison, lead guitarist for a reportedly defunct British rock and roll group. So they were, you know, the Beatles are over and George is in the studio working with Dylan. And they also went on to report that about five of the numbers are reportedly of high enough quality to merit inclusion on a future Bob Dylan album. So immediately the rumor starts that Harrison and Dylan are collaborating on an album. And it was obviously nothing of the sort. As you say, it was very casual, sort of charming. You know, they're just running through a lot of old 50s songs, some old Dylan songs,
yeah.
And just having a good time.
Well, George had hung out with Dylan, wasn't it, the previous August 69 at the Isle of Wight?
Yes. So we had that late 68 and then the Isle of Wight, and this, and George is very much cementing this friendship. You know, they're just, someone said this session sounds as if it's just two friends hanging out and having fun.
But George, and he's been very explicit about this, George is a massive fan of Dylan. It's not just a question of respect. He kind of thinks Dylan is an alpha and omega, again,
yes,
in a way that some people might think John and Paul are an alpha and omega,
yeah,
of songwriting. But he certainly affords Dylan, and I'm not denying they weren't friends, but he certainly affords him a respect for his talent that I never really heard him say about John and Paul.
No, absolutely. And I mean, he will, you know, all the way throughout his entire life, he will quote Dylan,
yes,
lyrics,
yes,
in interviews and conversations, the way other people quote poetry or snippets of the Bible. You know, he is throwing out Dylan quotes and working them in. And I think it's that admiration for Dylan's talent, particularly lyrics. Although, I mean, there is an interview where someone said to him, you know, what was it like working with Bob Dylan? Was it sort of slightly, you know, were you slightly overawed? And
yeah,
he said, well, maybe he was slightly overawed.
Well,
you know, so
maybe.
You know, I think that the foundation of their relationship is, I think, that they treated each other like equals.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that idea that, you know, if you live with someone, if you grow up with someone in the way that George grew up with John, grew up with Paul, had those formative experiences, you know their flaws, you know the bad side of their character, and they are just human beings. And it's that familiarity breeds contempt. Whereas with Dylan, he's dealing with a sort of a talent, an equal, and someone that affords him the sort of artistic respect and credibility that he doesn't get within the band, and I think within the Beatles, and I think that's the key to the relationship.
I don't think this Bob and George tape is going to make the Dylan bootleg series anytime soon. It's that kind of recording. They even there's a moment where Bob starts singing Yesterday.
That's very funny.
Yeah, which is kind of amusing.
Because he kind of crooks his way through Yesterday, and then at the end, George says, "Stick some cellos on that, and you'd get to have a hit." You know. So, but they do. So there's a song Working on a Guru. Mm-hmm. That they work on, so they're sort of jamming around that, and that's a kind of a co-write. So this is where we'll get a co-write on I'd Have You Anytime on All Things Must Pass. So they're kind of, the key point here is they're working together.
Yes,
and if you consider it's worth hearing this tape. It's a very kind of relaxed atmosphere in a way that just does not exist in Twickenham in 69.
And then the next kind of significant thing that he does in May 1970 and the next step on to making All Things Must Pass a solo album is he basically records everything, sort of a set of demos where he sits down with Phil Spector and goes through an endless selection of songs in a sort of one-man Easter demos type situation to say, well, here's what I've got on my mountain. And it's a tape where, it does circulate in bootleg circles. It's in good quality. And a bunch of these turn up on Early Takes Volume 1.
Yes. I mean, this is a fantastic bootleg and is well worth seeking out. This is... As you say, this is like the Isher demos. This is something that really I would love to have the Harrison Estate polish up and put out. So George has sort of been instrumental in getting Spector involved with sort of Instant Karma. So he's aware of Phil Spector, and he has decided he's going to get Phil Spector to produce his or co-produce his solo album now that he's committed to it. And this tape, as you say, it's literally George auditioning songs for Spector, saying, well, this is a song I wrote. This is the newest one, Beware of Darkness.
Yeah, that's a lovely introduction. And then he just starts singing Beware of Darkness.
Beware of Darkness,
With some words missing and all the rest, but it's still there. It's really good.
And, at one point he's saying Beware of ABCO, which is the Alan Klein company. So it's interesting that he's singing that. I'm guessing at that point is a kind of slightly ironic reference to Paul having fallen out with Klein, but this is an excellent tape. And as you say, there's six songs from All Things Must Pass in it turn up on Early Takes Volume 1, and they give you a sense of what this rehearsal tape is like. And this is what I want on the 50th, or perhaps it's going to be the 51st anniversary edition. Of All Things Must Pass.
We might talk about a potential box set later on, but certainly Early Takes Volume 1, which came out, I think, 2011, is an essential George record.
It's your favourite George record.
It's my favourite. Look, I'm holding it up now, if you can see that at home, people. So that's the next step, is where he gets all these demos nailed down. He recruits Phil Spector as a producer, and obviously Phil has just been doing the Let It Be overdubs, for better or for worse, depending which side of the fence you're on. And it's right at the end of May 1970 that he starts the real recording of the album in Abbey Road. And the recording will go from May to November 1970 before the album appears in December. And
that's it.
Who does he bring together to play?
Well, this is the thing. He is, as you said earlier, he's drawing on the people that he has worked with closely in the last couple of years. So the way it's structured, he sort of establishes, if you like, two two different bands, two sort of core units of musicians. So the first is Eric Clapton with Bobby Whitlock, Jim Gordon, and Carl Rattle. And if you, those of you who sort of know the album, will realize that's Derek and the Dominoes is forming there. So that group had got together at a session for a P.P. Arnold record. So they're brought on board, and that's the first unit. The other band, if you like, is Ringo, Klaus Voormann, Billy Preston, and Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. So again, you've got Ringo, Klaus, and Billy Preston, which is that sort of the side men that work with each of the Beatles. That's the kind of little tight little unit of session men that will work with George.
When you think
and
of Ringo and Klaus, what they did as a rhythm section in just 1 year in 1970.
Yeah,
All Things Must Pass, Plastic Ono Band for John, Plastic Ono Band for Yoko.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good CV for six months' work.
It's a hell of an output and a huge range of styles. So sometimes these bands will be brought together, these players will be brought together, but these are the core bands. Plus you've got Sidemen, you've got Badfinger are there, because Phil does like to have a thousand acoustic guitars hammering away. You've got Jim Price and Bobby Keys on horns. They'll work with the Stones. Peter Frampton is supposedly there. Phil Collins, possibly.
Well, the Phil Collins tale is quite a good tale, where he was, I think I might have mentioned already, I read Phil Collins's autobiography this year, and it haunts me. But he,
in a good way?
No, in a bad way. I read it and I felt, my gosh, has he enjoyed any of it? And what he seemed to do was, he seemed to have a fantastic 1960s Phil Collins, because he gets a big role as a teenage star in a West End show, and then he decides he wants to become a drummer. And then the tale is, he basically, through a friend of a friend, he just gets the nod one night to turn up at Abbey Road.
Yes, apparently the connection was some chap called Martin, who was Ringo Starr's chauffeur.
Right. Okay.
That was the connection, and I bought this book on your recommendation, or at least I thought it was a recommendation.
but you're still waiting to have a read.
Yeah, but I read this anecdote. So it's, I have to say that this anecdote is very well written, and the book, I'll not be asking you to reimburse me the cost of the book. But yeah, he says he was in the bath, and the phone rang, and he got out of the bath, and it was somebody saying, some guy's doing a session, would you like to come down and play percussion? So, and it was an Abbey Road. So he didn't know who it was he was going to see or what session. He just thought, Abbey Road, that's where the Beatles hang out. I might actually get to see a Beatle. And he's ushered into a studio, and they're in the middle of a photo shoot. So you've got, George and I think Eric Clapton had just left, but you've got Ringo and Billy Preston, and the whole kind of team are there. And George speaks to him and says, you haven't been here long enough to get in the photograph. Sorry about that. Then they spend the night. And I think it's Art of Dying is the song that they're working on.
Yes, and he's given congas to play.
He's given congas to play. So he said at one point he's sort of standing beside Ringo's playing the drums, and he's standing beside Ringo playing the congas and bumming cigarettes off Billy Preston. And he thinks this is it. This is George. Suddenly realizes George Harrison's recording his solo album. This is going to be on my CV.
Yeah.
This is my kick-starting my career. This is going to be great. And he said he's ushered out of the room, and then whenever he comes back in, everybody's gone.
Yeah.
And he said they've obviously all headed off to some party somewhere, and he's not been invited, but still he goes home thinking, Ringo's going to give me a call. I'm going to be George's drummer. I'm going to be thing. And the album comes out. He pre-orders it.
Rushes down
to the shops to buy it, scans through all the list of people who are listed on the thing, and his name isn't there.
I know, he doesn't make the final cut.
He doesn't make the final cut, and he realizes the track that he played on is they've obviously taken the song in a different direction.
And the amusing postscript is that for years, Phil wanted to hear some of the session tapes to hear what his conga playing was like, because he wasn't really a conga player at all. He was a drummer, not a percussionist per se. And eventually he gets a communique one day from George, doesn't he?
Yeah, so he sort of says, you know, he's met George on a couple of occasions, and on each occasion he sort of very casually said, you don't happen to have, you know, I'd be interested. And George is kind of going, you know, I don't remember you being there.
And this is years later in the 80s.
This is in the 80s. And then he hears through a friend that George is working on a remastering of the album, and he's thinking, this is fantastic. He's going to be going through the session. And they have a mutual friend in Jackie Stewart, the race car driver, who rings him up one day and said, I knew you were a drummer. I didn't know you played congas. And he said, what do you mean? He said, oh, well, you know, George is working on this album, and you know, he was saying he's got this tape of you. And Phil Collins is suddenly, oh my God, after all these years, and he's kind of going, would there be any chance, do you think? I said, oh. So eventually, long story short, a tape arrives from George saying, is this you? We find this is the session tape. And he said he was so nervous he didn't listen to it. And it took him days to listen to it. And then he put it on and it was awful.
There's just this crazy conga playing all over it, out of time.
Out of time and just absolutely. And he's thinking, oh my God, it's not that. And he said, then you can hear on the tape George saying to Phil Spector, can we try it without the congas? can we do it without the congas? And he said, this just absolutely crushes him. Crushes him.
And then there's a postscript to that, because he gets another phone call from George. And George says,
it wasn't you. it was Ray Cooper. We just recorded that tape last week. I had the session and I said to Ray, just get in there and play some really bad congas.
I have to admit, that does fill me with joy, just winding Phil Collins up over the course of about 30 years.
I was going to say, it's like a 30-year... It's very funny. He I have to say, Phil Collins takes it very well.
He does. I don't know. You read that book, he feels like he's smiling through the tears a lot of the time, you know?
Okay. I'll
take my word for it.
I will do.
To May 1970, and this has been the road to recording All Things Must Pass. We have a massive stockpile of songs. We have an amazing selection of musicians assembled. We have Abbey Road, the greatest studio in the world, and they are ready to lay it all down. But I think that's where we're going to leave it for today. Because as we said, this is going to be a gargantuan task, plotting the course of All Things Must Pass, a triple episode, so you will. But it's all ready to go, isn't it? How could he fail? It's all good stuff. So we're going to follow this up in two more episodes, covering All Things Must Pass to celebrate its 50th anniversary. So we hope you'll come back and join us for those then. We remain available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod. We have the private Facebook group, which Stephen will let you into. And, you know, if you enjoy downloading and listening to the podcast, we appreciate any kind of review that you can leave us in all the usual places. But for now, my name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.